I started my first business when I was 14. That business is my second most successful business. I had a lot of failures after that.
You kind of get obsessed with newsletters and see this business opportunity.
AI was growing. Newsletters work fundamentally. If you can get enough people to read it, you can sell ads against it. That was enough fuel I needed to get started.
That's kind of your skill, is to see that opportunity coming and just to act on it.
Yeah, we went from making like $5,000 to $6,000 to 20 to 30, like in 1 month.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Today, we're speaking with Adam Biddlecombe, co-founder of Mindstream, a daily newsletter about AI and tech that he started with a friend, Matt Village, in June of 2023. Just under a year and a half later, it was acquired by HubSpot for an undisclosed sum. They're both still working on the newsletter, just as part of that larger organization. And today, Adam and I will be speaking about how he grew the audience the time they acquired another newsletter, pivoting from music to newsletters, and plenty more. Adam, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. That was so smooth. You really have a radio voice.
You know, it's taken me a year and a half to get here and a lot of voice control. I will say I was at a wedding in October and I had to do a speech. And I was really glad that I'd been podcasting for a year, because otherwise I would not have known how to use the mic.
Love that. It is different in person though, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
It's a bit translatable, but not directly.
Yeah. I mean, well, for one, my hands were really sweaty, and right now they're not, because it's just me and you, and I'm just sat in my office. And at that time I was in front of, you know, a couple hundred people or whatever. Anyways, neither here nor there. Before we get into talking about Mindstream, because that's obviously what we'll be doing most of the time here, I did want to talk about that you come from a background as a musician, because this came up in another interview I just did. It'll be, I think, actually, it might be, as when this comes out, the one directly before. I just interviewed Jesse Feister, who is the executive director of Webby Media Group. So they do the Webbies. And he also has this background as a musician, except in a different era, in like the MySpace era, in the aughts. He was signed to multiple labels, et cetera. And then he got an MBA. And he now is, you know, before he was the executive director of Webby Media Group, he was the head of creator marketing at Twitch. So it's this great arc that you kind of mirror, and you really lay it out on your LinkedIn. You specifically say that being a musician taught you how to sell your band, how to organize travel logistics, how to manage finances, and how to build a brand. And I should also say, before you went from music to newsletters, you spent a few years in sales. So tell me about like how you spun that experience and skills into like more of a white collar professional realm.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't intentional. Music was everything for me. I started playing drums when I was like 10 years old, and all I wanted to be was a musician. I started my first business when I was 14, and it came from me and my like friends at school had put together a little band, and we wanted to do some gigs. We'd like got a set list together, some originals, some covers. And I kind of went door knocking. So my first experience of sales, trying to get venues, pubs, whatever, to like put on our band. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have like a media kit. We didn't have a CD. We didn't have anything. So
you didn't even know what a media kit was. You're 14.
Exactly. Exactly. So then I, and to this day, this is probably one of my best skills. I just found another way to do something. Mm. I just went out and hired a venue. So I hired a music venue and I paid £100 for this venue, and it came with a sound engineer. And then I went online and got some tickets printed, booked a support band, got some posters done, went and flyed like all around my town and my school. And then we sold out this show. So I played my first gig, happened to be one that I'd organized, to a sold out room of 100 people. And I made like £500, you know, I sold it out, made some money. And then over the next 4 years, I part-time doing music alongside being an events organizer. Oh, okay. And that business is my second most successful business. I had a lot of failures after that, but putting on shows, I expanded to like 3 cities, a couple of shows a month in each city, and managed to keep selling shows out, making a load of money. And that, you know, really set me off down the path of business.
Yeah. I think I want to talk about the events organizing aspect of that for a little while, because that's something that I know even people I know who are really good at it kind of hate it because there's so many moving parts. But because it's this thing with so many moving parts and like you have to, you know, satisfy so many people on the organizing side and, you know, the customers, the attendees, I think it's kind of like a, it's something that can really forge a lot of skills as it seems to have for you. So tell me more about like, about your experience organizing events and how much it sucks.
To relate it to tech, I sort of cracked affiliate marketing without knowing what it was. The format that I used to do these shows is I'd book a good headliner, pay them a little bit of money, and then I'd book four or five support bands that would all be like school bands, like 16, 17 year olds, you know, like I was in that same situation of I couldn't get a gig. No one would take a chance on me. So I book all these bands, and because a lot of these bands were doing their first or second gig, they would be able to sell loads of tickets. So I would give them 10% of ticket sales and I would take 90% of the revenue, and then they would sell all of the tickets for me. And the people that would come to the shows would be like mums of the band, like cousins, sisters, schoolmates.
But they're buying tickets.
They're buying tickets. And then, you know, a lot of these bands were pretty good. Some of them weren't, but a lot of them were. And it was a great breeding ground for like young, talented musicians. And then everyone got to have a good time at the end watching the headliner. You know, the real kind of like pull for the event. So luckily, when I was doing these events, you know, I had these venues that I had long-term relationships with. The hardest part was discovery. But as soon as I found these bands, that was it. They'd sell the event for me. You know, I'd turn up on the day and make sure everyone was happy and make sure everyone was, you know, had everything they need. But these shows would sell themselves eventually.
Yeah. This is, okay, I'm going to float this idea I've been working on, this framework, which I also brought up to Jesse, kind of talking about the same thing. I'm calling it the agency horseshoe. You might call it the graft horseshoe. You know, you're somebody who clearly has a lot of graft, as they say over there in the UK. But on one side, you know, the horseshoe theory where basically there's kind of maybe an ideological difference going to either end, but they kind of at the other end, they become similar. So it's, I call it kind of the tech startup business. You can just do things like culture on one side, and then more of like DIY punk, like warehouse party type of artist culture on the other end. And maybe one is more about profit and the other might be more about art or whatever. You know, it's not perfect, but people like you are really, you kind of are at the middle there. And I think that's what it means to be like a successful creator, in the sense that we talk about creators, is you have to have a good grasp of both that business side and the art side. But the important thing is like the ability to just do things, to have graft. And you kind of have to be able to speak to both sides of it in the creator economy to be successful. Thoughts?
Yeah, 100%. I think there's a lot of similarities between the creator economy and art, music, whatever. And we weren't massively successful when I then went on to do music full time. You know, I said I did this events business for 4 years. I then went and did 4 years.
You were an events organizer more than you were a musician, you're saying.
4 years for each. So I spent 4 years making a living out of music, like fully supporting myself and my band. We like lived together in a flat down in London out of music. And we weren't very good. We didn't create very good music. We never found the right artistic message or profile or sound that makes musicians successful. Successful in the eyes of the world, you know what I mean? But we were incredibly successful in that we spent 4 years traveling around the world playing music.
You paid your rent in London with this music.
We paid our rent in London. And the reason that we were able to do that is we had business sense. You know, we didn't really have the necessary artistry, but we had the business sense and we knew how to make money. We knew how to market ourselves. We knew how to build a brand. And that was enough. And it's very rare to find somebody who has the artistry to be a musician, yet also has the business sense to make money out of it. This is why a lot of the artists that we see being successful, you know, they sort of do the artistry thing and then they have a team of people around them who do the business thing. You know, you look at maybe Ed Sheeran as one of the exceptions. And I think the creative economy is very much the same. There are a lot of people out there who build big followings online, but then when you kind of dig into it, they're not actually making very much money. And to get the perfect balance, you can build huge, huge, huge businesses. And there are some examples of people doing this correctly. You know, on the big scale, you have someone like Ryan Reynolds, mm-hmm. who is paid a lot of money for making movies and could be very, very happy with that amount of money. But he manages to build up all of these other assets by being, or at least surrounding himself with real business people.
Well, somebody like him too, it's like, I feel like he doesn't, even his movies, it's like he doesn't really make movies. He makes franchisable creative assets, right? Like he's not really an actor's actor. He's a producer's actor.
Yeah. Yeah. At the core, he's a business person that is able to market himself. And that's what every good creator is. They are a business person first and foremost, who are able to create an image of themselves that people want to buy into.
Yeah. Okay. So we should talk about Mindstream and where this comes in. And I think this is actually a good transition in that the kind of graft as a service, and I'm using the word graft just because I think it rolls off the tongue better than high agency. Graft as a service is kind of one thing that you bring. And you start it with your longtime friend, Matt Village, who's a copywriter. And what I understand, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, is you kind of get obsessed with newsletters and see this business opportunity. And you come to him and you say, hey, you're a great writer. And I know you can like pull off writing every day. And I'll grow the audience and I will, you know, sell the ads, whatever. I'll monetize this thing. Which that's kind of this graft as a service, I'm saying, where there's these people like you who really understand the business sense and then can work with people who can crack the creative sense to ultimately really nail a project like this. But the way I want to go into Mindstream is I want to know how you identified like this specific opportunity and decided that you wanted to make an AI newsletter. I know you're one of these people who listened to The Hustle or listened to My First Million, heard about The Hustle, heard about Milk Road and said, I can do that.
Yeah. So it's lovely looking back at it in hindsight. It looks incredible, incredibly agentic and intentional. It wasn't really that in reality. I had spent a lot of time being an entrepreneur doing music. You know, it was artistic, but it was entrepreneurial at the core of it. And then the reason I gave that up is when COVID hit, obviously all the gigs were cancelled and that was the end of it. So I had moved back from London to my hometown in Leamington and had to get a job. I'd never had a job before. I was 22 years old, hadn't gone to university.
Only done the entrepreneurial thing.
Yeah. And like, music, man, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. So I had to go and get jobs and I quickly realized that they suck and I don't like it. So I knew that there were other ways to make money and I started trying to make money in different ways. The first thing I did was matched betting, which made like a little bit of money. Then I tried for a good year and a half at e-com, made a little bit of money. None of these things were growing quick enough. So there was one day where I had just pure frustration. I'd hit a wall with this e-com business I was trying to build. And I called Matt, who is my best friend. And we, when we were younger, when we were like 13, 14, we used to say we'd build a business together. We would hang out after school and think about business ideas.
Were you in a band together or was he not part of the music?
No, he wasn't music. He wasn't musical at all. I called him and we were both pretty unhappy with where we were in life at that time. We were both working jobs. And, you know, we weren't doing anything particularly impressive. And I just berated him for like an hour on the phone. And it was mostly me venting my anger at myself. But it was like, what are we doing, man? Like, we're not...
You're lighting a fire under his ass, but also your own.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And I said to him, come around to my house and we won't leave until we have a business. I had a little office at the bottom of my garden, 2 by 2 meters, tiny little space. We went in, locked the door, and we said we're gonna make a business.
Yeah.
The reason we landed on newsletters is because I had been sort of, I think, subconsciously building up the knowledge to build a newsletter. I'd listened to My First Million, I'd followed The Hustle's success, I'd followed Milk Road's success. I'd heard Shampuri say 6 months before someone needs to go and do the Milk Road for AI. So this was the idea that I said to Matt, how about newsletters and why not AI? Because it's AI was growing rapidly. Newsletters were growing rapidly, like especially with the launch of Beehive, it was so easy to build newsletters. So I said, let's just go after this AI newsletter thing. It seemed the obvious thing, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't massively intentional. we hadn't really studied the marketplace and saw that there was a gap straight away. I just knew that AI was growing. Newsletters work fundamentally. They're simple. If you can get enough people to read it, you can sell ads against it.
Yeah.
That was enough fuel I needed to get started.
Hey, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider subscribing to the podcast. We release a new episode every Tuesday. All right, back to the show. Okay, so tell me, I think on your LinkedIn it said that at month five, you both quit your jobs to go all in on this. Tell me about the path from like, you're locked in your garden shed to, okay, now we can quit our jobs.
Yeah, so 24th of May, we locked in the garden shed. 1st of June, we sent the first issue of Mindstream. And he talked earlier about Matt being the creative. He's a great writer. He's always been a great writer. He made a bit of money with a blog, like when he was about 15 years old. He wrote a book and like sold it, like quite impressive stuff for a kid.
What was the book about?
How to make money online.
It's a little manifestation.
Yeah, exactly. I said to Matt at the time, like, I need you to commit like a couple of hours a day to write this thing. That's kind of all I need you to do. And we'll sort everything else out. So day one, 24th of May, the same day, we like bought the domain. We designed a logo with some AI image generator back in 2023, set up emails, like set up our Beehive account. I created a new LinkedIn account because I had my LinkedIn account that I was doing like outbound for my sales job. I created a net new LinkedIn account, which you're not supposed to do, and just started posting about AI. The reason I wanted to go after LinkedIn is because I mentioned I was using LinkedIn as a salesperson for the last couple of years. I had spent a bunch of time when I was kind of supposed to be working, just scrolling through my LinkedIn feed, and I'd started to follow AI creators, but also personal branding creators. The main one was Lara Acosta. Mm-hmm. And day one, I bought her like how to get started guide for $30. And I just copied it. Like I posted every day. I used carousels, infographics. I connected with people in my niche. I did all the like basics of like personal branding 101 on LinkedIn. And then anybody who had gave me like a sniff of interest, you know, liked a post or view my profile, I'd then send them hundreds of DMs to sign up to Mindstream until they gave in and signed up. And I just like, we just, grafted, like you said, just grafted at that stage until we got to maybe like 1,000 subscribers. And then Beehive did a Boost promo. They dropped like, if you'd spend $2,500 on Boost, they'd match it. So me and Matt put in $2,500 out of our pockets, bought those Boost credits and started growing with Beehive. And then by the point that we were at like 3,000 subscribers, we had this outbound from this guy in Canada who wanted to invest. And I remember talking to Matt and being like, we don't have anything. Like we weren't even registered as a company at this point. We hadn't made a dollar. Like what the hell are we going to charge? And I sent him this deck, like I did all this projections and stuff, sent this deck. And I asked to raise at $500,000 valuation. He said no, unsurprisingly. But then I was chatting to my colleague at work, my like fellow salesperson.
Yeah.
And we were just chatting about the newsletter and how we were trying to grow and all of that. And he mentioned that his cousin likes investing in startups. So we met with Paul Ingram, and we hashed out a deal. Again, we had like 2,500 subscribers. I think I had like 10,000 followers on LinkedIn. And we secured this investment that meant that me and Matt...
From the cousin, not the Canadian.
From the cousin. Yeah. The Canadian... The Canadian didn't bite, but my friend.
But he got the ball rolling.
Exactly, and it's that's the thing, you know. When I'm sitting here now, I'm spending a lot of time trying to understand what my real assets are, like what I can double down on to make success, and I really think it is seeing opportunity rather than being very good at any one particular thing. You know, this guy reached out to us who wanted to invest in us. He was a seasoned investor. You know, he was part of like a family, I'm not even sure what you call it, like a family investment group type like thing.
Family wealth management fund. I'm financially illiterate, so I forget what they're called. Family office. Yeah.
That's the thing. Like he had money to spend. He had targets, set by the family.
Newsletters are hot at this time. People want to invest in them.
Yeah, yeah. But we had nothing to show him. So he couldn't, you know.
What do you want the money for besides just like, oh, now we can maybe quit our jobs and pay ourselves to do it? Is it just that? Is it paid growth? How are you using the money?
It was time. It was really time. Mm-hmm. But the deal that we hashed out with Paul, my friend's cousin, he ran still runs a marketing agency called K-Web. So the other thing we locked in part of the deal was we had a bunch of infrastructure support from them. Mm-hmm. So they ran our books, they ran our SysAd, gave us marketing support. They like built our website so that we had a bunch of other things.
Something you're actually acting like a proper business.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that deal, we sort of like penciled that out. And that was enough for us to leave our jobs. We hadn't actually signed this deal. It happened a couple of months later, but just sort of seeing that and also a little bit of revenue starting to come in, we realized we could quit our jobs. And then another opportunity landed on my lap, which really, really changed the game for us. I started connecting with a guy called Mattis. He reached out to us on LinkedIn because we were building up a following on LinkedIn. It was all on LinkedIn. He could see we were making money through like sponsorships. And Mattis had quite a large newsletter, but was struggling to really monetize it in the right way, hire a team or whatever. So me and this guy just started going on like weekly.
Which this is also, for the audience, this is also an AI-focused newsletter. It's called AutoGPT, correct?
That's the one, yeah, yeah. So we just started going on weekly calls, sharing information, and AutoGPT had like 170,000 subscribers at this point. And the way that Mattis had got all these subscribers is he had bought the domain autogpt.net, started creating articles and blogs on there as like a bit of an SEO play. And then the open source tool AutoGPT got launched like 3 months after he'd launched his site. And he just took all their traffic. It was a hugely viral tool, crazy on like X. And he was suddenly getting like hundreds of thousands of visits a day on his site and managed to capture all these emails. So I was in a position where we had 5,000-10,000 subscribers at this point, like a little bit of money, but a very, very clear plan. Whereas Mattis had a huge number of subscribers, but didn't really know the industry.
No clear plan.
No clear plan. So eventually we were able to secure a deal that Mattis joined Mindstream, bought his subscribers, brought his domain in exchange for 30% of our company. And that just took us to another level.
Like, so he comes in basically as a co-founder with that sort of investment.
He comes in as a co-founder. And when you look at it on paper, you know, some people might say it wasn't a great deal for Mattis, because there was a value against those subscribers. There was a value against that domain. And he was getting 30% of an idea, really. And again, that's where I pride myself on being able to see an opportunity and make a deal happen. And at the end of the day, we're all very, very happy. Paul's yeah. very happy with his investment. Mattis is very happy with the deal we made. And we're all very happy with the eventual deal we made with HubSpot. So yeah, it's not a traditional newsletter growth story. It's a story of deal making, really.
Yeah. Well, this is it's funny the way that he comes in. He's got all these, like, you know, what, 10 times more as many subscribers yeah. as you guys. And he's willing to take a chance on you guys in that way. It seems to me that, again, it's like you having this like graft as a service almost. Like I promise this isn't just because you're British, but I've been watching a lot of soccer, a lot of football recently, and it's almost like you are situating yourself as the person who can make that line breaking pass, right? And like somebody like him can maybe be the pacey winger who can go run, but you're the one who's going to have the line breaking pass, and that's kind of your skill, is to see that opportunity coming and just to act on it.
100%. The deal was very, very difficult to get along the line. It very nearly didn't happen. Mattis had a bad experience with the previous co-founder, so he was reserved against going into business with people. He was in Slovenia, so all of this conversation was happening online, and I'd sort of pitched him on the deal, shared the terms we were happy with, and I remember him calling me. I remember I was driving. He called me and said, "Dude, I just can't do it." And I said, "Drop whatever you're doing, get on a plane, and just come and see us." And the next day he flew out.
To meet in person for the first time.
For the first time. He flew out and we rolled out the red carpet for him. We took him to a soccer game.
Yeah.
We took him to the Aston Villa. And then we spent 2 days at K-Web's office. So I mentioned Paul, our investor.
Yeah, yeah.
We took him to his offices. We got all of the team in. So there was like a huge buzz about the place. Booked out the conference room. The K-Web team had worked on like an amazing deck. You know, Paul Ingram, the investor, he's been around the block, had a lot of successful companies, exits, investments.
He knows how to land the deal.
He knew, yeah, exactly. And what I did, and I said to Paul and the team, there's a guy called Adam Dunning, who is an investor as well, and Matt Village. I said, I need you to lead this. I don't want to say a word in any of these meetings because I have already said everything I could possibly say to Mattis. I need you guys to lead this. And they absolutely smashed it. And Mattis, you know, he told me after he was sold on the infrastructure and he was sold on the value of Paul as an investor and a strategic partner for the business and the marketing services that K-Web were going to offer us and, you know, that whole infrastructure. So getting that deal over the line was integral. We couldn't grow fast enough to compete with the other AI newsletters. If, for us to go from that 10, 15,000 subscribers we had at the time of the acquisition to 100,000 we eventually imported to 100,000 subscribers, it would have taken us maybe a couple of years doing it organically or probably $200,000 to $300,000 if we were
well
to do that.
I mean I about a year ago I spoke to one of your competitors at the time, maybe you were just on their podcast the other day, AI report formerly AI Tool Report, and when I spoke to Martin Crowley there, like, he was able to scale very quickly. I forget like the exact number at the exact time, but around when I spoke to him, it was already at like 500,000. They'd been doing it for like 10 months. So they would have started right around the same time as you and scaling quicker, but through paid ads. And you guys didn't have the money to invest in paid ads, whereas he already had the personal fortune to be able to invest in that.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. We couldn't compete. We didn't have the money. That model that Martin has taken, he'll probably take quite a long time to make his money back.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to speak for him, but when you acquire a newsletter subscriber, you're looking at 6 to 12 months before you're making that money back on advertisement. So it doesn't recycle quickly. You know, you can't acquire a bunch of subscribers 1 month and then have the money back at the end of the month. You know, with a traditional sponsorship model.
After you acquire AutoGPT, you now have 100 some thousand subscribers. How are people coming in after that? Is it word of mouth? Do you start paid growth? Is it kind of self-sustaining? What's the churn and acquisition looking like?
So we were able to turn on monetization very quickly. At the point that the deal was done, we were making most of our money through LinkedIn sponsorships. So we probably had 20 or 30 clients who'd bought a LinkedIn post off us. So we were able to quickly go back to all those clients and say, we now have a substantial newsletter list of engaged subscribers. Do you want to buy some ads? And we were able to quickly sell out our ad inventory. We also found this like huge hack for getting leads of advertisers. We were able to get the top spot in the top AI newsletter blogs for the top three searches on Google. So one of them, I can't remember the name of it. Two of them we kind of reached out to and negotiated to put us in that top spot. And the other one, we created that article on AutoGPT and bought a load of backlinks on it and put ourselves at the top spot. And we would get, it was at least a lead a day who came through and said, oh, I've seen you on this blog or whatever. And people were just going into Google and searching AI newsletters or best AI newsletters. And this is how they were doing their discovery on who to advertise for, who to advertise with. So we were always on the top of that list. So we were able to turn on monetization. We were making like 20 to 30,000 bucks a month. So we were then able to invest, you know,
this is post AutoGPT. This is about 8 months in, you're making $20,000 to $30,000 a month.
Yeah. We went from making like 5 to 6,000 bucks to 20 to 30, like in 1 month after the acquisition.
How, when did you make your first dollar in month one? How long did it take to start making money?
It was probably 1 to 2 months. I remember the client. It was a company called Dante who do chatbots, and they'd reached out to us and bought a LinkedIn post for about $100.
What were you offering at that point? Like, how large was your LinkedIn following approximately, do you think?
It's got to be under 10K, I think. Yeah. Like close to 10K. I should look back through the messages and find out, but yeah, it wasn't much at all.
Mm-hmm. What? Tell me about the evolution of your revenue model and like your revenue streams over time up until the acquisition.
We were quite simply a sponsorship newsletter. We did a couple of other things. So we created a digital product that we sold on the thank you page. The whole point of that was to try and we were always trying to reduce our CPA of subscribers and then increase the instant revenue. Mm. So we'd make a little bit of money from Sparkloop or Boosts, and then we'd make a little bit of money from selling a digital product, like averaged across all of the subscribers. I think we got it up to about 80 cent or a buck that we would make like instantly. And we were acquiring subscribers for about $2. So we used to call it like real subscriber acquisition cost was like a dollar.
Yeah.
So we were always optimizing for that. We were always making a decent amount of money from LinkedIn. Like even when we were making 20, 30,000, it's probably still like 10,000 coming in from LinkedIn. And that was always increasing. We started selling webinars as well. So I would interview like founder of a company on LinkedIn, and we'd always bundle that in with a bunch of newsletter ads to promote the webinar, some LinkedIn posts to promote the webinar. And we'd get like, you know, a few thousand people sign up to these things to come and see like essentially a product demo of, you know, AI company or whatever. Yeah. That was it really. You know, sponsorships, digital products, and monetization through LinkedIn.
Tell me more about the types of digital products.
We only had one that became successful, which was ironically an email course. So it was like a 28-day master AI content creation. So it had like, you know, how to write copy with AI, how to create images with Midjourney, how to create like blog posts. It was just like 28 days of this premium email, and people paid $30 for it.
Not bad. I do want to talk more about the LinkedIn growth. So you, as of today, I just checked right before we hopped on here, have like 200,700. When I was prepping for this a couple days ago, not 48 hours ago, you had not yet cracked 200,000. It was like 199,700. And I saw that. I was like, I'm going to come when we get on the call, he's going to have passed it already. And you did. You're bringing in hundreds of new followers a day on LinkedIn. And I think Matt is around 147,000. Now it's clearly just self-sustaining. You know, people are attracted to the big number. You post a lot of content. They flow in. I know you said it was the Laura Acosta course at the beginning that really got the wheels turning. You had no real social media presence. That it was just like following the basic principles, but actually following them. We've already established you're somebody who follows through. Is there anything that like people who are trying to grow on LinkedIn maybe don't understand that you think you do? Or is it literally just the like, just actually do the things that you're supposed to do?
Yeah. So one thing that people do, which I think is a mistake, is when they have 500 followers, they'll emulate what someone who has a million followers does and then go, well, why doesn't that not work for me? I always think a great example of this is Sahil Bloom. Mm. For anyone who doesn't follow Sahil, he has like a huge following. I think he's got over a million on X and like 500,000 on LinkedIn. And the best way I can describe Sahil is he takes advice that we should all know, yeah, and wraps it in the most beautiful way.
Well, he's one of these male lifestyle type of people who he's very handsome. You know, he's rich.
Well.
It's very well packaged, right? It's like you want to be like him. And so that's why you want to follow his advice.
Exactly. And when you read one of his posts, you go like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, of course. Like, thank you, Sahil. But it means something because it's from him. Mm-hmm. Those points you just made, he's like in great shape. So he clearly looks after himself.
Got a family.
He has a family. He is very public with his family, and he's very wealthy. So he has all these things. So he gets to post generic advice on the internet and get hundreds of thousands of yes, impressions. You don't, right? Like if you don't have anything behind you, you don't get to do that generic advice. You've got to work harder. And I'm pretty sure if you looked at what Sahil was posting when he had 500 followers, it would be a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. You know, he would be working a little bit harder. And that's not to discredit the work he does now. As we said, he wraps these things very beautifully. When I was growing, I would look at what the biggest creators were doing for inspiration, and you can look at them for best practices, how to structure your post, how to format your copy. But in terms of the actual content, I was looking at creators who had like 2,000 to 5,000 followers, and I was jumping on calls with them and I was networking with people. I had so many like WhatsApp groups over the years of people who'd just be like, I've just got my first viral post. Like, this is how I did it. And I just started like bumping up them, networking with people who were like growing more and more. I used to have probably like 5 to 10 calls a week with LinkedIn creators. I was just hacking. I was just learning every possible thing I could on how to grow. And, you know, the way that you grow today is probably different to how you grow on LinkedIn 18 months ago when I started.
So I think it's telling that you just said you were part of these groups and people collaborating, sharing feedback, et cetera. Like, I think that in all this talk of like solopreneurship and the creator economy, a lot is lost that I firmly believe work is a social endeavor, and especially on social media, like you need to be allying with people. I'm working on an essay for tomorrow's issue of the newsletter, and I'm still working at the argument here. But one thing I'm talking about is, you know, in the creator economy is made up of humans doing things, offering services and software around the three core tasks of creating, growing and selling. And within that, there are many opportunities to compete with people, collaborate with other people, and exploit people. Somebody who's really good at selling might be really exploiting the labor of somebody who's really good at creating, but doesn't understand how to sell. So that's one side of it. But you're illustrating this aspect of like, you need to look for opportunities to collaborate, but you're also competing with those collaborators. You're playing multiple games at once, but you have to be conscious that these are the games available to be played, and you have to play them.
Yeah. If you go out there just to exploit, you'll get found out eventually. You'll end up very quickly swimming with sharks. Me and the people I was engaging with are very aware that we were competing in some ways. But there's like so many people on LinkedIn, and we were all doing something slightly different. You know, I was building an AI newsletter that made money out of sponsorships. Somebody that I was sort of directly competing with for audience on LinkedIn was running a ghostwriting agency. Yeah. Somebody else had a copywriting course they were trying to sell. So, you know, I didn't collaborate too much with people who were also building AI newsletters. Or if I did, they were a different scale to me. You know, I remember...
You're competing in different games.
Yeah. Aways from Superhuman was very helpful to us when we started. You know, they had like 500,000 subscribers at the time, but he took time out of his day to chat with me and give me some advice when I had 2,000 subscribers. So you've just got to, you know, build relationships with people, be there for them as they are there for you, try and give as much as you take, and that will compound over time.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about you as a creator now that your company has been acquired, but I think first we have to get to the actual acquisition. So at the time you get acquired, you've been doing it for around 17 months. I think in October of last year, of 2024, was when this formally happened. Before the actual offer comes in, tell me what you built the business to. I think there was like 10 employees, some full-time, some part-time. I'm not sure. Tell me the state of the business, let's say in like August, September, 2024, shortly before the acquisition.
Yeah. So we started negotiating with HubSpot in April. So April hit and those conversations started.
So you guys, you've been doing this. The garden shed moment is like 11 months before only.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was insane. HubSpot started advertising with us in February, and that was a huge moment for us. And then they were obviously out looking for an AI newsletter, and they saw great results from our advertisement and accelerated the conversations pretty quickly. But as soon as things got serious in those conversations, my role as the leader and the CEO of the business changed from grow to maintain. I didn't want to rock the boat. HubSpot coming to acquire us was, you know, the dream that we didn't even think was a thing that could possibly happen. So I wanted to do everything I could to make that deal happen. And it took a lot of work, you know, being acquired by a company the size of HubSpot. It's not like a phone call. It's not like when we acquired AutoGPT, you know, it's a lot of conversations with lawyers, a lot of information sharing, a lot of presentations and spreadsheets and whatever.
You didn't do much due diligence on AutoGPT is what you're saying.
Not a lot, no. So my job became manage that process and then also just steady the ship, you know, keep executing, keep the quality up, keep growing, keep making money, but not really change anything.
Yeah.
You know, I think if we hadn't started having those conversations with HubSpot, we would have grown horizontally. We would have launched, we were looking at launching a tool directory that was like in the works. We were looking into the possibility of some sort of education-based platform. You see, I think AI Report, Rundown, Superhuman have all launched like university type things. So we were looking into that at the time. And we just kind of put all those plans on hold and just focused on getting the deal done.
So they come in April and they are starting, that conversation is starting to happen. And you're like, well, I need to keep sustaining the business so I can keep making a living and my colleagues can keep making a living, but also kind of starting to lay out the carpet for HubSpot coming in and buying us. So I guess, what does that transition look like where you're balancing, okay, we got to keep money coming in. HubSpot doesn't necessarily need to make ad revenue off of this. That's a whole nother conversation we can get to. But like preparing for that acquisition over these 6 months, I know there was a team of around 10. I know they couldn't all come with you to HubSpot. How are you paving the way for like all the adjustments in the business?
A lot of focus went on to editorial. I mean, the focus was always on editorial, but we knew we had to keep the quality of the product at the highest order. Whereas maybe like growing the revenue became less of a priority. Yeah. You know, it was important to maintain the revenue, but there was
especially kind of when the ink's not dry, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we were never sure it was going to happen until the day it happened. But I knew that if we kind of kept the ship operating properly, obviously made sure there were no skeletons in our closet and that we had like, you know, business infrastructure set up correctly and all that kind of stuff. And it was very difficult for me to like keep motivated on the day to day and keep my team motivated because I was always selling them on this dream, and I had to keep selling them on the dream without telling them that I was kind of working on this other dream. So until we actually signed the paperwork, most of the team didn't know. You know, we weren't allowed to tell them. We were under NDA. Our employee, Maria, HubSpot wanted to bring her on. So she was relocated to the UK and she came and joined the team. We didn't tell her until about a month before the acquisition. And that conversation was, hey, HubSpot are probably going to acquire us. Also, you live in Lebanon and they can't employ you there. So you're going to need to move to like either the UK or the US. Are you cool with that?
You can leave or you can move.
Yeah. And fortunately, it had always been Maria's dream to come to the UK. Mm-hmm. So she's here. That's now awesome. And having a great time. But yeah, that was difficult, especially, you know, not knowing whether it was ever going to happen. And I can't tell you how many conversations I had with Matt and Mattis where I went, okay, do we proceed as if nothing's going to happen, or do we try and optimize for the deal to happen? Like we went back and forth on that like 100 times.
Constantly having to kind of test your conviction. I would love if you could tell me one or two specific growth or revenue experiments that we haven't spoken about that were failures, things that you can learn from the dust.
Yeah. So, my main one that I was like really excited about is the idea that you could do email outbound to drive subscribers for a newsletter. I haven't heard anybody do this successfully.
Maybe there's a good reason.
Yeah, maybe there is. But fundamentally it made sense to me. You know, so when we tried it, we like acquired leads through Apollo for like, I don't know, less than a cent a lead. And then we bought like 20 domains, variations of mindstream.news or whatever, used instantly to send these outbound emails. And yeah, we tested like reply to subscribe. So we just email people and say like, you know, in your position, you might want to read this newsletter. It'll be great, whatever. When we kind of did it manually and it was like, do this action, like reply to subscribe, we got good enough numbers, but the cost per acquisition wasn't good enough. We really messed up at one point and we put a Beehive magic link in these emails. And then everyone's like, email spam scraper things were like auto subscribing them to the newsletter. So we put this, I remember when we kicked off this campaign, we were like, we've got it, we've cracked it. Like the subscribers were flying
it's
in.
It's rocketing. And then,
yeah. And then when they had like 0% open rate and like 100% spam rate, we were like, okay, something's wrong here. We've broken something. So yeah, we never got that done. I still think it can be done if you're a great copywriter and you can do like outbound emails, because essentially you are just giving someone something valuable. You know, if you can convey that you have a great newsletter that is specifically tailored to them, I think it would be better for a niche newsletter. Like, you know, if you had a newsletter to help real estate developers or whatever,
and it's you not kind really of like a mass market tactic, because those mass market leads are going to end up being too expensive, or the lifetime value of them, if they become subscribers, isn't really going to be able to offset the cost of acquisition.
Yeah, I agree. So I think that there is something there. We just never hacked that. And we spent quite a lot of money trying to make that happen. Probably like $5,000 to $10,000 went down the drain with that experiment.
Well, you gotta spend some money. You gotta break some eggs, make an omelet to get acquired by HubSpot.
Exactly.
That's what the saying goes, right? Okay. A little bit more about the HubSpot acquisition, because I know we are running up on time here, and there's a few things I want to get to. The revenue model for listeners, maybe I don't know if we've said it explicitly, is now very different. You don't sell ads. HubSpot is basically the advertiser, in that you have this high quality content product. I understand this is kind of the model for the entire HubSpot media ecosystem, which has grown quite large. You deliver great content to different audiences that are tech and business related. I'm speaking there to the HubSpot Media Network. You're specifically AI and tech. And the advertising product is maybe gated content, a digital product that's free, but you give your email and become a HubSpot lead.
Yeah, 100%. I love it. It gives us so much creative freedom. Like, I think, you know, when we talk about our competitors now, like the AI report, they're not competitors anymore.
You're not competing for the same ad dollars.
No. They're competitors editorially, though. We're both trying to create a great resource that people want to read.
You're competing for the same attention hours still. Yeah.
Exactly. But the huge advantage we have is we don't need to make money off people. So these are the newsletters. They're making money through advertisement. They're also making money through gated content that you have to pay for. You know, a lot of them, like I said, are launching these universities. So their highest value educational content, they have to put behind a paywall. We don't. We have freedom to make our editorial product as good as possible. And the goal of that is to keep people reading it. The other amazing thing, like we talk about HubSpot being the advertiser. When we worked with external advertisers, we used to have deliverability problems. Like we always had deliverability problems running Mindstream.
Yeah.
You know, we would have a 40% open rate one day and then a 25% open rate the day after. Since the HubSpot acquisition, we've sat at 45%. Like every single issue gets 45, you know, will go up or down 1 or 2%. And I think that is because of the consistency in advertiser. You know, we're not bringing in all these new names. HubSpot isn't using like spammy ad copy, you know, like free trial and all of this kind of stuff. And the all the ads that HubSpot place, they are gated resources that like a great team of people at HubSpot have spent hours and hours and hours creating. Like the monetization team at HubSpot is like I think it's more than 10 people, and their job is just to make amazing resources. So I don't feel bad like putting these resources in our newsletter. I feel great about it. And like, I'm using them myself all the time. Like they create amazing, like prompting templates and like, lists of business ideas and eBooks and all of these things. So when you're a Mindstream reader, you get, I can say you get the best editorial content, and then you get all this amazing stuff that you know, have to type your email in to get.
Yeah. About the acquisition process for any other newsletter operators who have a product that they maybe want to sell, that they want to be acquired, what would you say are maybe three things that they should focus on, or how to set yourself up as attractive to acquisition?
Yeah, so we had some other offers along the way. If you're looking to sell your newsletter, you need to think about what an exit is like for you. I think there's three types of exits with a newsletter business. The first one is somebody who sees the money you're making and wants to have a part of it. So they're going to acquire it contingent on you continuing to run it and make money for them. This is one of the offers that we had. It was someone who wasn't from the media business. They were just like, we want to like buy it and you keep running it. And we're going to
from the money business.
Yeah. So I would have gone from making money for myself to making money for someone else. Obviously I'd have got money.
You get a short-term payout, but you have to keep doing the job. And eventually it kind of, what, you know, you scale and you actually might end up making less money over time.
Yeah. Yeah. The second option is you get bought up by a larger media organization that makes money through advertisement. The Neuron has just been acquired. I think it's a German company that's acquired them. And I think they make money through like finding leads and stuff. I don't think it's purely advertisement, but you get sucked into a bigger organization that does a similar thing to what you do. And then the third example is what we had, where you get acquired into a SaaS company that has a media arm. They're all very, very different things. And if you're going to go and work on your newsletter for a longer period after, think about what that means for you. If I'd have gone for option A, I would have gone from selling ads every day to selling ads every day with KPIs. Whereas now I've gone from selling ads every day to being able to spend all my time marketing the brand. So my job has got better. assuming like you don't love sales, I don't think anyone loves sales.
Yeah.
So my job has got better. Okay, so three things to like prepare yourself for the deal. Understand all of your numbers. Understand your you know basics like your open rate, your click through rate, the amount of money you make. Understand the LTV of a subscriber. Understand your growth rate. Understand your churn. The churn was like the hardest ones for us to understand because we'd not been running for very long. When we looked at like the last year's churn, the subscribers that we acquired on like month one was like my dad and my cousin. And then you're looking at how they behave a year later, like there's 50 subscribers on day one. So hopefully you have a bit longer than a year's data and you can really understand all those things, because you might get valued on purely revenue, like a simple revenue multiple. You might get valued on the asset of your subscribers and how engaged they are. So you have to truly understand them.
Okay. Let's say you get laid off. HubSpot lays you off tomorrow. You're out on the street. You've got no job. Would you do this again? Would you do a newsletter again? Would you do a newsletter in AI again? Or do you think you'd be on some new harebrained scheme? What would you do?
I'm really interested in influencer marketing at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think, obviously, I monetize a newsletter through advertisement, which is essentially influencer marketing. My LinkedIn account has grown to 200,000 followers, and I see the value that I create for the brands I partner with. Some of the brands I'm working with now, like I couldn't have believed I'd be working with 6 months ago. And also, the way that I kind of sold ads on LinkedIn over time has changed, and the type of brands that are coming to the platform have changed. And I really think that this is a big wave that's coming, essentially B2B influencer marketing. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited in this. I think the next company I build will be in this space. I have spoken to a few friends who are building in this space. My friend, Lindsay is building a company of like micro influencing. So the idea that a company can go onto a platform and place ads with like a CMO at a software company that's got 3,000 followers, rather than going to like a tech influencer, like reaching out to like people with like true credibility. I think it's fascinating. I think newsletters, LinkedIn, and also potentially YouTube is going to really, really grow in this business-to-business marketing space. So I think I'd build something there.
I would agree. I think there's a big opportunity there. Partially as you were saying that too, I start thinking like, you know, in a year, in 3 years, let's say I'm still doing this podcast and this future comes to pass, right? Is then everybody, like if I reached out to you, would you be, hey, actually, you're going to have to pay me $1,000 to come on the podcast? And I think there's different things. Is, you know, there's financial capital, cultural capital, content capital that can all be exchanged, and it doesn't have to be only financial capital. But yeah, I'm just wondering what a future looks like where everybody is a marketer all the time.
Yeah, I think people are charging for podcasts, but people are charging for podcasts because they're good podcasters and they're going to bring a bunch of distribution. Yeah. I'm not in the podcast world, but I don't think there's a lot of charging that goes on. I feel like it's like people go on podcasts that are sort of beneficial for both parties. Mm-hmm. The crazy thing is with B2B influencer marketing is if a brand partners with a creator, the CPMs that you can get at the moment are like better. If you partner with a creator on LinkedIn, you'll get better CPMs than buying LinkedIn ads, which is insane.
Because LinkedIn ads are terribly inefficient, from what I understand. Yeah.
And those impressions are so much more valuable because they're tied to a trusted creator rather than just like distributed ads. So, I think it's a little bit like Meta was like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like,
I wonder if LinkedIn would introduce a creator advertising market within the platform.
They've just launched the ability to kind of mark a post as a brand partnership.
Mm. So I've seen some of these in my feed.
Shows up as an ad. They also launched thought leadership ads. So a brand can partner with an individual on LinkedIn. So they can put ad spend behind an individual creator's post. So they are moving in that space, but it's like not good at the moment. Like LinkedIn is not a good, like, for example, when I do a post, I can't get analytics to show the advertiser. I can tell them how many impressions it got. I can tell them the top five cities of the people that viewed it. But imagine if I could get a report that said, you know, 15,000 impressions, 73% male, top job title is CMO. Mm-hmm. Here are 20 target leads based on the content you gave out. Like that would be an insane offering.
This makes me think one reason maybe that people are always talking about how like, why does LinkedIn like, you know, hamstring itself as a social network? They could like the kind of thing you're talking about, or like, why do they make it so links get suppressed in the feed, et cetera. But I also know that LinkedIn as a social media platform makes far more money than Twitter, X, and a number of others, because it's the only social media platform that people pay for, that people will pay $50 a month for, or whatever it is now, because it is a social media platform, but all the more it's a job site. I've gotten multiple jobs there.
I would pay $1,000 a month for LinkedIn to give me proper analytics.
And then that's a tier. There's LinkedIn Premium, and then there's like LinkedIn Creator or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%.
So sorry, LinkedIn product managers, if you're listening. No, I was just going to say, tell me about Adam as creator. Now that you don't have to be a creator on LinkedIn to grow your audience and make revenue specifically for Mindstream, your incentives and priorities are changing, but you're still bringing in hundreds of followers every day. So what is the Adam as creator project now?
Yeah. So a large part of it is I still like to promote my newsletter. I still send across my account and Matt's account, probably like 3,000 to 5,000 subscribers to Mindstream every month. And selfishly, it just like helps me hit my KPIs at HubSpot and keeps everyone happy there. I do that. I use LinkedIn as a distribution channel for like Mindstream events. So every month I host a webinar, which is like a Mindstream event. And we use mine and Matt's personal brands to like build up hype for that, as well as advertising it across the newsletter network. So that's just like a purely brand boosting play for Mindstream and HubSpot, which again is a thing I can do in my role. Like I can put on these events that don't have to make money. They can just be boosting the brand. So I get to work on these like fun creative things. At the same time, I'm kind of leveraging my position at HubSpot and the relationships that are available to me there to do like really cool things. So like yesterday, I was speaking at the finance offsite for HubSpot alongside our VP of marketing, Kieran Flanagan, who's like one of the best voices in AI. So because of the fact that I am a influencer with 200,000 followers and I'm an employee at HubSpot, I get asked to do all these cool things. So that was super fun. I'm going out to San Francisco in a couple of months to speak at the HubSpot for Startups AI Growth Summit. So I'll be moderating events there. I'm moderating an event with the CRO of Vanta and the CEO of Clay next week. Mm-hmm. So like, because I am an influencer at HubSpot, people at HubSpot go like, oh, I'll get him to do this cool thing.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of fun. And it's all brand building and experience building for me. And at the same time, I partner with like really cool brands to promote their products.
There you go. Machine keeps on rolling. This was a great conversation. Thank you for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Any last thing you want to plug before I hit that stop recording button?
Just reach out. If there's anything I can do to help anybody, if someone wants to know how to grow their newsletter, how to build on LinkedIn, how to do cool stuff with AI, like I'm always happy to chat. So don't hesitate to reach out.
Who's available? All right, folks, thank you for listening. I will see you next week.